Okay, so welcome to this interview we have. I'm very pleased to welcome Johan Brunel, who was the performance director for a number of cycling teams and has, within the past couple of years, been given a lifetime ban from the sport for his involvement with the US Postal Team. So in this podcast, in the interview, we're going to cover a few of the issues around how that happened, but particularly some of the issues relating to anti-doping organisations and how they behaved and how that has impacted upon Johan. So I'd quite like to start just with a general question, really. So the course of the process by which you were given bans, you know, it started off as, was it 4 years, and then it became 10 years, and then it became a lifetime. And, you know, I just wonder, but from your perspective, you know, how did that happen, and did you consider the fairness of that?
Yeah. Hi, Paul. First of all, thank you for having me, and appreciate the opportunity to elaborate a little bit on my personal experience. Of course, it's how I lived the whole process. So yeah, if I remember correctly, I mean, it's already a little bit back in time, but 2012, somewhere, I don't know if it's June or August, but anyway, USADA started this, they had done this investigation, and then they charged me and Lance Armstrong and a few other staff members with all these accusations. And then, you know, I have the whole process until finally I went to CAS and with the end result, a lifetime ban, asked from WADA, I think, and then, you know, confirmed by CAS. You know, it's been a long process, and, you know, on the way I've learned a lot of things about how the anti-doping system works, and more specifically of how the legal part, the legal aspect of this whole anti-doping, how would I say, and I would call it an anti-doping business rather than an anti-doping system, because let's not forget, you know, all these agencies are funded by government money, and I have the feeling that sometimes it becomes a business, but yeah, I mean, it's been a very interesting process. As of today, you know, I've come to terms with the lifetime ban. I've accepted it. I want to state before anything that I do accept responsibility for what happened, not necessarily for all of the accusations of the anti-doping agency USADA in this case, but, you know, I do accept that we were part of a generation where things were different in the sport, and more particularly in the sport of cycling, than they are now. We can easily say yes, okay, that was the norm, that was the culture, that's true. But that doesn't necessarily make it right. So I do accept that, and I do obviously looking back on everything with everything I know and where I am now in my life, I do regret that certain things happened and that I was part of certain decisions that happened. I wanna make that clear before anything. Before going into certain details of the whole process. So, but yeah, I mean, it's been an interesting and sometimes frustrating story. You know, first USADA comes with these charges, and you know, I've always said from the very beginning, together with my lawyers, and then with the opinion of a lot of different external lawyers, completely separate from my defense, that you know, the fact that USADA, an American anti-doping agency, charged me and sanctioned me with initially a 10-year ban. It was initially a 10-year ban, was never supposed to happen, because these cases have happened in an arbitration environment. And in order to have an arbitration, first there needs to be an arbitration agreement. That's like that in all walks of life. And there is no arbitration agreement. There was never, has never been an arbitration agreement between USADA and myself. So going from there already, we always felt that that shouldn't have happened. There was probably other organizations who did have jurisdiction over my case. In the first instance, the Belgian, I'm a Belgian citizen and I had a Belgian license. So it was the Belgian Cycling Federation, and then consequently probably their proper anti-doping organization. And of course the UCI, who I had a license with, right? But I never had any arbitration agreement or license or any type of agreement with USADA.
Yeah, that becomes really interesting then, because the whole kind of process of you ending up with a lifetime ban begins with that foundational point that it was USADA who collected the evidence. It was essentially non-analytical evidence, so it's based on other people's accounts. And you've said, you know, publicly, or certainly within some of the arbitration or appeals documents, that you felt as if USADA had portrayed you in a different light, that they'd over-exaggerated your role in the doping system, and that other people were probably, you know, as responsible or more responsible than you were. I mean, am I correct in saying that?
Well, you know, I'm yes and no. I mean, I don't think it's about responsibility. You know, I don't wanna try to shift the blame on or responsibility on somebody else. I was part of this system. First of all, you know, let's go back. I mean, if we're talking openly and transparently, you know, I was a cyclist, a professional cyclist between 87 and 98. So, you know, obviously I have come into contact, was presented, was offered, and took part in the doping practices during my career, the doping practices that were current during that period. You know, I always say, you know, it's easy to, I mean, anti-doping or you know, doping or not doping, it's not a black and white question. It's not a black and white situation, you know. And first, you have to be able to, in order to judge, you have to be able to put yourself in the position of, let's say, for example, let's go back to a cyclist. Let's say, you know, one cyclist at some point in his career has doped, whether it was in the late 80s or during the 90s, which was obviously a whole different era than now. But let's just take the 90s, right? Where we by now we all know that you know, late 80s probably, I would say 88, 89 probably, until early 2000s or mid 2000s, EPO was the drug that appeared, then, you know, got introduced to the sport, was used extensively, then less. And then finally, a little bit, and hopefully now, not anymore. So, you know, just I think in order to make it to make up your mind, you have to be able to put yourself in the skin of an athlete, a young guy who starts. You know, they have a hobby, it's their passion, they have a dream. Some of them are talented enough, and some of those talented guys put in enough work that they're able to be at the top in the amateur, on the amateur level, and then finally make it to the professional. So basically, that's what I saw. Also, I mean, when I started being a professional, EPO was not there yet. At least I don't think so. But I felt the same thing, and I think that happens with all athletes. You know, when you get to the professionalism of the sport, you are all of a sudden confronted with first of all the best athletes worldwide, of not just of your generation, of different generations, because you're young and they're still the best champions of a generation more earlier than you. So So normally, if the process, if the natural evaluation goes through, you know, you are you're talented. You've made the sacrifices. You have the discipline. You have the work ethic, and you make it finally to the big league. And then after 1 or 2 or 3 years, you come to the conclusion that you're doing everything you can, and it's not enough. And then at the same time, at least, you know, in my period in the 90s, it was like this. You come to the conclusion that, you know, people who you were basically stronger than before, all of a sudden they're with you or they're riding away from you. After 2 years, 3 years, I would say, you start to figure out there's something going on. In the case of EPO, for example, that was the case. EPO, compared to other doping methods, was a whole different level. You know, when I started as a professional, that there was other whatever there was corticosteroids, there was anabolic steroids, there was testosterone and stuff like that. So those were, that made a difference, but none of those things made such a big difference as EPO. EPO, it was not a question of, you know, will I or will I not. It's either you do it and you keep up, and if you're good enough, you're a bit the best again, or you just go home. That was just, it was as simple as that. There was such a big difference between yes and no. So just imagine, you know, a young athlete who basically, I mean, in the majority of the cases, there is no plan B. You know, they've started when they're 15, 14, 15, starting to take it serious at 18. So most of the athletes, now I see that changed a little bit. But, you know, back in my days and even earlier on, even more, none of those athletes had a plan B. It was, they made all, that was their evolution towards a future or their breadwinning, basically. So when you're 21, 22, 23, and you figure out that this is not enough, talent and, you know, taking care of yourself, nutrition, you can't go back, because there is, what they're going to do? There's no, you know, they have no education, you know, there is no plan B. So basically, some of them had to go back, but you want to hold on to that for as long as you can and see if you can stay in that big league. So, you know, it's not so easy to say, okay, yeah, you know, they did that and it was, you know, they doped and it was so wrong. Of course it's wrong, but it's not a black and white question, and it's not an easy, you know. So I mean, I'm not trying to take a position to say to defend it, but it is definitely a very sensitive subject, and not so easy to judge. In terms of, I mean, I would say the mainstream public that say, okay, yeah, you know, this guy doped or didn't dope. You know, let's say in my generation, as a cyclist, the in the top league, I can say that the vast majority at some point in their career they doped. Some of them with EPO, some of them without EPO, but that doesn't necessarily make it better or worse, you know, because I have the impression that, you know, once EPO came into the game and then EPO was detectable and then it became blood transfusion, that whoever did that is seen as the bad guys, and the guys who didn't accept EPO or blood transfusion, but did other things, for example, corticosteroids, it's a performance-enhancing drug, although it is, you know, a medicine that is used broadly in normal medicine, but it's still performance-enhancing. So, you know, that's what is difficult to say. Okay, it cannot be that there are good dopers and bad dopers. You either cross the line or you don't. You know, there's not bad murderers and good murderers. At least that's how I see it.
Yeah, thank you. That's very, very honest and open reflection upon that time period. And even within that time period, given, you know, what we know now, your contribution to the sport is quite incredible. You know, your record of achievement as a manager, in particular, a performance director, that has, you know, that in essence, you helped to transform the sport. And you've ended up with a lifetime ban, which, you know, many people would say was fair, but that lifetime ban is, even when it started as a shorter ban of 10 years, mm-hmm. it's had a profound impact upon your life as a whole. It's really changed your life in terms of your career, your reputation. Would you mind saying a few words about that?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I mean, I would like to start from the beginning, as that, you know, and this is probably one, like the big, how would I say, red wire through this interview, is that in my opinion, and after my experience, and after have talked to several people who had to deal with the legal side of anti-doping, is that anything which is sports legislation, and anti-doping I think falls under that, is a completely different ballgame than normal legislation. You know, I've asked opinion to a lot of different experts from other countries, and you know, anybody who has had a quick look at, for example, the USADA recent decision, as they call it, I prefer to call it the unreasoned novel, or like a sensation. It's not a report. It's like a novel. It's like whatever, how you want to call it, sensational report, right? But anyway, if you break down all the legal issues, for starters, in any ordinary court, there would never have been a case. You know, as I said in my letter after I received the ban from CAF, you know, the grounds on which this decision was taken would never have stood in any court. So, you know, there was the jurisdiction issue, there was the statute of limitation issue, which is, in my opinion, it's a big one. And then there's the proportionality of the sanction, which always has to be considered in any legal case. And then there was the right for equal treatment. Basically, you know, those are four basic legal principles, which in my case and in other cases have been completely disregarded. And you know, neither USADA or WADA or CAF has been accountable to any other organization to explain why they made those decisions. They are not accountable to anybody. So yeah, but obviously, you know, my life has changed a lot since I would say, you know, independently of the whole process, which took from 2012 till 2018, basically, when I got issued the lifetime ban, you know, I received my lifetime ban in June of 2012, when USADA came out with their charging letters, and I think, I mean, a little bit later, the recent decision. That was my lifetime ban. It was over for me, you know. In the beginning, I've tried to, how would I say, I've tried to defend, my defense was basically, in my own mind, was based on principles of, okay, this is not fair. You know, I knew that we had crossed the line many times, as I knew that all of my colleagues or ex-colleagues and all of my ex-colleague cyclists had done in the past, and then at the end, finally, now so much like this is now eight years later, right? I've come to the conclusion that you know, fighting for what you think in your mind is not fair, is stupid, because you know that's what you think, and I've seen that, you know, I mean, justice normally, I mean, even in ordinary justice, real justice, or you know, defined justice, really doesn't exist. It depends on how you are portrayed and what kind of resources everybody has, right? I was at the time of being charged, I had considerable resources, and I thought by myself, okay, I'm going to utilize a big part of my resources to fight this. And you know, this 6-year battle has cost me dearly in terms of finances, incredibly dearly. But also in terms of, you know, my energy, my state of mind, it's, and if I look back now, and I see the outcome, it's not been worth it. But at the same time, if I think now, you know, we are having this conversation now, and, you know, because I have been defending myself for such a long time, I now have a lot of knowledge and experience, and on top of that, facts and information, which, you know, I would like to include some of the documents, supporting documents, in this with this podcast. That I think that you know, people can learn from it. People can learn from it, and of course, it's always difficult to break a system, you know. But I think that the system of anti-doping needs to be reviewed. You know, it's easy to say, oh, you know, it's okay because, you know, whoever cheats, until you are in a situation where, you know, and it's been proven, there's a lot of people who have been confronted with anti-doping system, whether it's their national governing body or WADA or CAS, with very doubtful infractions, sometimes even contamination, not voluntary. And they have to go. They have to go through the same thing. You know, you're guilty, and then it's up to you to prove that you're not. Now, I'm not comparing this with us, right? I repeat, we did what we did. But if you break it down technically, as in any court case, in whether for any infraction of the law, every person has the right for a proper defense based on the law. And what I've seen is that the law, in terms of anti-doping, is, you know, it's very, very up to the in French they say, à la tête du client, like, you know, whatever, for whatever purpose it has to serve, right? And I have a few examples of that, you know. So in my case, let's say, and in Armstrong's case, and in the case of all the people who were charged together with me. First of all, USADA, they just, you know, did whatever they wanted in order to get to their objective, you know, which was they wanted the head of Lance Armstrong. And of course, I was his associate, or, you know, his director. And, you know, as of today, I'm very happy to say that we're still very, very close friends, even closer than before. So, you know, if anything good of this came is that, you know, the bond between Lance and I has been strengthened, rather than, you know, nobody has turned on anybody, and we all knew what happened. But, you know, you have to know who is who and why certain things happened, right? So in the case of USADA, for example, they just did whatever they wanted in order to get to their objective. You know, just let's say, for example, to start with, you know, they obtained testimonials from 6 or 7 ex-cyclists that were on U.S. Postal in those days. You know, all of those ex-cyclists at a minimum were supposed to receive 2 years, and then because of the substantial assistance clause, which allows an anti-doping agency to offer a reduction of 75%, they got 6 months. You know, they got 6 months, but they could choose when, which was in the off season, which was already, you know. And then on top of that, and that's, I have had gone many times into discussion with Bill Bock, who's the, you know, who's the lawyer for USADA. There were, I think, 4 or 5 testimonials that, you know, basically these ex-cyclists in their own declaration towards USADA had declared by telling their story that they were actually engaged in what they call legally trafficking, because they were exchanging doping products, one shipped it to the other. So that's trafficking in terms of anti-doping. And so if you look at the law, that's a minimum of 4 years, minimum. And so, which could have been reduced to 1 year. You know, I've many times asked the question, why did you break your own rules because you didn't even want to consider this as trafficking. And, you know, they always brushed it off by, yeah, you know, nobody has ever said that this is trafficking. I said, listen, you don't have to be an expert. You read the affidavit. I'm telling you that's trafficking after everything that I know now. And any independent anti-doping expert would say that's trafficking. So minimum 4 years, 1 year. They didn't do that. And so they don't have an answer for that. You know, so this is basically one of the many examples, which, you know, I hope that in the supporting documents I can afford a lot more. But so yeah, I mean, it's really a frustrating process to go through if you really feel like, you know, any means or good, whether it's legal or not legal, they are able to interpret their rules differently, bend their rules, and break their rules in order to get to their objective. That's, you know, one of the main things that I have experienced with USADA and in other situations also.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Thank you very much. You know, it's a very kind of honest account of someone who's been through that process. And I think there's two things which I'd like to just ask you about directly then. So one was that in the aftermath of in the late 2000s and into the sort of early 2010s, you did try to do some things to support anti-doping. You ensured the Astana team was clean when they returned, and you gave evidence to the CERC report led by Brian Cookson. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's...
Yeah, I mean, you know, in terms of this, first of all, when I took on Astana, I did. It was obviously. I mean, times had changed in cycling by then. It was 2008, so there was the introduction of the biological passport. So the mentality of cycling had changed of the cyclists and of the team directors, the doctors, the supporting staff, everybody. There was different rules, let's say. And so on top of that, since this was a team that, you know, there was, I inherited like 22 riders, and I brought 8 riders from Discovery Channel. And so, you know, I said, well, you know, this is obviously, things are different now. We need to do this properly. And since there's a lot of unknown factors here, I hired an external anti-doping expert, Rasmus Damsgaard, then the Danish. You know, I think it cost us like €350,000 to hire him for the season, and we set up a really internal system, which was a lot stricter rules than the UCI anti-doping rules. You know, that's never been talked about. That's been completely disregarded. But anyway, I don't want to take credit for that. You know, it was what it was. It was what I had to do, and it worked. And then in terms of the CERC, you know, this famous report that Brian Cookson, this commission that he installed when he became president, I did collaborate with that commission. I went 2 days to Lausanne, and I spent lots and lots and lots of hours with them, basically giving my account of my experiences in the sport, both as a cyclist and a team manager. Yeah, I mean, I was very, very surprised to see that afterwards, when I read the report finally, months and months later, nothing of my testimonial was taken in there. Nothing, zero. Just simply because it wasn't interesting, you know. Brian Cookson, in my opinion, the CERC report was pure PR maneuver for him to say, okay, I do investigate the past, and I don't want to be blamed for the past. That was his only intention at the end. If I see, because if it would have been about anti-doping, really. If it would have been about anti-doping, it would have been, you know, there would have been other things in there. And, you know, he spent €3 million on it, coming from, you know, all the stakeholders of cycling. But it finally wasn't, you know, it didn't change anything, this report, in my opinion.
I'm aware we've only got a few minutes left, and there's one thing I'd like to specifically focus on. So you provided us with some documents demonstrating that you were approached by a National Anti-Doping Agency who was not USADA, and this was in 2013. I wonder if you could explain that for us, please.
Yes. Well, you know, this is a clear example of what any anti-doping agency is able to do. I was approached by an anti-doping agency, which was not USADA and not my own, which would be the Belgian, through my license. And apparently this anti-doping agency it's a bit the same situation that with USADA. They were after information that they thought they could use in order to really score big. And they were convinced that I had information about this person. And so from the very beginning, I discussed this with my lawyer. I said, you know what, I'm surprised that they want to talk to me, because my first doubt was, okay, if we collaborate, and they offered a very reduced sanction. I didn't have a sanction yet back then, so I was not suspended. It was still in course. You saw that I was treating with this. And so the first thing I said to my lawyer, I said, okay, you know, this might be interesting. Let's see what they want. But I said, you know, if we are contesting the jurisdiction, the authority of USADA, how can this anti-doping agency have jurisdiction over me, because I don't have an arbitration agreement with them? And so it was unbelievable. They came up with a completely manufactured maneuver that said, okay, you know, I was instructed to affiliate myself with a federation of that country, which was not my country. So completely artificial instructions to become a member of a certain federation, which was a sport that I didn't even practice. But apparently it was quite easy to get a license from that federation. They instructed me, I have emails about this. I actually have my license, my physical license of that federation, of a sport I didn't practice. And so finally we made an agreement. I had, I think, 2 days of meetings with them where I talked. So I basically told them what I knew, but I already knew on beforehand two things. That first of all, that this agreement, to make it clear, these people, this agency had looked at the USADA recent decision. Their lawyer had looked at it. And they had determined that based on the accusation, taking into account the statute of limitation, which USADA has never done, that my maximum ban could be 4 years. So based on the 75% rule for substantial assistance, they could offer me 1 year of sanction, which is a contract that I signed with them, which we will publish in addition to this podcast. So I signed this contract with this other anti-doping agency, offering me, you know, or basically agreeing that I was going to get a ban of 1 year in exchange for the information that I was going to give them with supporting documents. Now, what I did know on beforehand was that, number one, WADA has always the right to appeal anything. So, you know, they would appeal it, and so it wouldn't stand, number one. And number two is that, you know, I did this actually as a test, because by then I have figured out that they can do anything they want in order to get to what they need. And so I was never going to transfer the supporting documents, but I do have the contract. So we did make an agreement. It's signed by me, it's signed by them, and it's an agreement for substantial assistance. They have broken their rules, you know, left, right, and center, by saying, okay, you become a member of this federation, we have jurisdiction over you. We say it's 4 years, you get 1 year, and we get what we need, right? Now, this document exists, it was signed, and it will be published. So it's a clear example of, you know, and it's exactly the same what USADA did. You know, they signed deals with people that, you know, that just you know, to do anything that in order to obtain what they want. And you know, in the same lines, you know, and I don't want to, you know, it's not about blaming or you know, but if I look, for example, as of today, I'm banned for life, which I accept, which I have, you know, I've moved on. And on the other hand, one of my generation colleagues, both as a cyclist and as a manager, we are the same age. We were in the same situation as a cyclist and the same situation as a manager. Bjarne Riis has admitted in Denmark in front of the commission what happened as a cyclist and during his time as a manager. There is no difference at all between what he experienced and what I experienced. The only difference is that there they did respect the statute of limitations. And today, Bjarne Riis is active as the team manager of a new team. I mean, I applaud him for that. I think he's a great manager. Independently of his history, it doesn't mean because you were part of an era that you can't move on and use that experience in order to improve the sport, which is, I think, what Bjarne is doing right now. But just to see to show the difference in different agencies, because the Danish anti-doping agency had the same kind of investigation with Bjarne, and you know, he made his confession, but they did respect the statute of limitations. So basically, yes, he said he was guilty, but there's nothing that legally that could be done, which should always have been the case in my case too. But anyway, that's a different story.
Okay, I'm afraid we're running out of time, but I have to say that was really enlightening. It was very honest and it was very balanced, and I appreciate that you've taken the time to reflect upon all those things and communicate it with us. So just to wrap things up, I would just like to reiterate on behalf of the INDR as a whole that we really appreciate you giving your time, you know, being so honest and contributing to our series of stories that people have about their own involvement with anti-doping, and yours is, you know, very personal and very impactful upon your life and your career as a whole. And those inconsistencies, those legal issues, you know, they're all really important that they come to light and are openly discussed. So yeah, we appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you for having me. And, you know, as usual, you know, with these kind of, I mean, I could go on and on and on, but, you know, I hope that you know, in a nutshell, I could explain a little bit my experience, that people can learn from it. And also, I mean, if I look now, as of today, where I stand as a person, you know, I've learned a lot about this, and both in terms of what happened in the sport, but also as a human being. So, yeah, I mean, you know, I'm ready to move on, and you know, my life goes on, and luckily, you know, I am in good health, and I have two beautiful children who are in good health, and I still love the sport of cycling. So I'm still trying to find ways to contribute by sharing my experiences, and hopefully everybody can learn a little bit from it. Thank you very much for having me.
That's okay. Thank you.
Thanks.